Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have an important show. I'm looking very much forward to it because I'm going to speak with a colleague about our healthcare system. We have a lot of things going on, a lot of people who are pronouncing how healthcare should be, whether that's single payer, whether we should have a free market system. And I don't think a lot of people really understand it. It's a lot of emotion. And quite frankly, I'm always of the mindset you need to follow the money. I want to bring it back to the basics. Today, I'm going to speak with a doctor who can speak about the most important thing about healthcare, which is the doctor-patient relationship. And today, I want to welcome Dr. Paul Pender. He's an ophthalmologist. He is a blogger and an author. And today we're going to speak about his book, Rebuilding Trust in Healthcare, A Doctor's Prescription for a Post-Pandemic America, which is extremely timely because with everything going on in the Supreme Court or about to go on in the Affordable Care Act, we need to actually speak about what it means for doctors and patients and what it means for us going forward. So Dr. Pender, I want to thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me on your program.
One of the things that strikes me about you is that you're an advocate for the doctor and the patient. And to me, that's the most important part, the foundation of healthcare. And as a clinician, you practiced for 38 years in healthcare and as an ophthalmologist. How did you come to write the book? Because you, like I have, been on the front line, and I'm sure you've seen, as I have, changes that I don't particularly welcome them. So I want to know what really spurred you to go down this path.
Well, it was a bit of a lengthy path, so I've actually prepared some remarks that I think might be helpful to understand where I was coming from, and it really has to do with telling stories. So I would like to just read a piece that's from my blog because it'll kind of outline where I came from.
Sure.
Storytelling. A powerful communications medium with the chance to get into someone else's mind and connect through experience. Sometimes the experience is vicarious because not everyone has lived with what the storyteller has, but the storyteller's words can have a profound effect, and the listener can appreciate what is told within a recognizable context. The works of Shakespeare are an immense collection of stories of triumph and tragedy, of love and sacrifice, of comedy and play on words. His characters were often of the nobility, but the messages in his plays spoke to universal truths. Shakespeare's audiences were rarely of noble means, but they felt a sense of involvement with the actors, a connection created by story. Storytelling has its roots in language across the spectrum of human communication, from cave paintings to hieroglyphs, from campfires to podcasts. Storytelling provides a glimpse into the storyteller's life, but it shares something even more valuable in the life lessons it has for current and future generations. As I was approaching my retirement from medical practice, I received a brochure describing the Harvard Writers Course for healthcare professionals, and I decided to attend. What I learned from the faculty and attendees changed my attitude about giving up what had been my professional identity as a doctor. Through writing, I could assume a new purpose, to tell stories of my patients and to provide insights into the medical profession. One of the books I read on writing well captured my thoughts at the time. Quote, memoir writing is an important kind of writing. Memories too often die with their owner, and time too often surprises us by running out. I committed to writing a memoir, and I submitted a book proposal to a publisher I'd met at the Harvard Writers Course. My proposal was rejected, as was my follow-up proposal on mentors. That made me think that perhaps I shouldn't quit my day job. However, I continued to write essays and stories for popular social media platforms, including Kevin MD, where physicians, advanced practitioners, nurses, medical students, and patients share their insight and tell their stories. It was after my essay was published on what would have been my mother's 96th birthday that I was contacted by the CEO of a healthcare startup. A conversation ensued, and he set the hook for my involvement by saying, "I think I know how you can get your memoir published." I was asked to advise his company on how the patient-physician relationship could be leveraged to retake control of healthcare. Accepting that role meant that I would need to broaden my view of our healthcare delivery system, and I began reading books and articles that spoke to the breakdown in that sacred relationship between patients and their doctors. Then the coronavirus attacked, and I now had to face the juxtaposition of distrust in healthcare with a pandemic. Fortunately, by that time, I had developed a sense of how a prescription for rebuilding trust in healthcare could be formulated, and I began writing during the COVID-19 lockdown. Things happened rather quickly after that. My editor for Rebuilding Trust put me in touch with a publisher who is also a graphic designer. We scheduled a series of phone calls to follow the script for developing my imprint, selecting a book cover design, and getting my book published. From there, her contacts led to the ebook version, and what followed was the audiobook that will be available around Thanksgiving this year. I have a lot to be thankful for, and the stories will keep on coming. So there's my story in a 5-minute nutshell. And really, I started writing because I felt it gave me a way to express what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. And it just made me kind of concentrate on some of the issues that were affecting patients and physicians today. And I really felt like the story had to be told. So having gone through the readings and the books and coming across your book on big medicine, I realized that this whole system is really broken and we need to find ways to fix it. But we have to really speak on behalf of our patients, because who else is going to do that?
I absolutely agree. I think that there's been an attack on the doctor-patient relationship, and they did a wonderful job of making us doubt each other. Patients first, and then the doctors after. You know, I think it's all about transparency, isn't it?
It is.
So you don't know how much something costs, and someone is telling you from an insurance company that you don't need to get it done and imply that it's just a doctor trying to make money on the patient. I think that starts the ball rolling against the doctor-patient relationship, and communication is one of the most important parts. One of the things that struck me as we've changed from the doctor-patient foundation to this corporate-driven healthcare system was the loss of time. You know, we didn't have the chance as physicians to spend enough time with our patients. It was all about volume in order to stay open. I think that opened the door for this problem. What do you think?
I think it's a problem that's pervasive. And what I've heard most from patients is that, there just doesn't seem to be enough time to express what I need to express. And the doctors are having to take work home to complete their medical records. This is, called pajama time, but it's really destructive. And I think too many clerical jobs were assigned to doctors in order to satisfy requirements for the federal government and for health insurance plans.
I absolutely agree with that. It's almost like it's all about getting as much data from the doctor and patient. And that's not commensurate or equal, I should say, to giving care to the patient.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting. We're at our first break, so let's do that and come back. You're Living in the Solution. Welcome back to Living in the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Paul Pender. Again, he is an ophthalmologist. He's had 38 years of clinical practice. He's now the author of Rebuilding Trust in Healthcare, A Doctor's Prescription for Post-Pandemic America. And before the break, I think we were trying to really get to the basis of how this started. As physicians and patients, I think we need to take responsibility, because I do remember when I left medical school, one of the things when I opened my practice was the mindset, you have to have insurance, you have to take it, or you won't have a patient. It was all driven by fear. And the patients were of the mindset that I can get top dollar and spend $5 copay. you know, it's somebody else's money and I can just do me and it'll be really cheap. So I think we both discounted each other. And that's our fault, I think, from the doctor-patient perspective. Nothing is for free.
No, I agree. But I also think that you were among the brave docs who decided that they weren't going to accept insurance. And basically, you wanted to have that individual relationship with your patient without a third party. And I congratulate you, but there are a number of docs who are more risk-averse, or just, as you said, sort of suffered from the mentality that if I don't follow what they tell me to do and accept insurance, I just won't be able to make it. So I think that when it comes to, you know, direct primary care or being able to have those relationships with your patient and be able to actually make a go of it economically, I mean, I tip my hat to you.
Well, I want to be honest. I didn't start out by being insurance-free practice, and I'm not now. I'm a surgeon, so I can't do that. But what I ended up doing down the road is reading my contracts and deciding what I was not going to tolerate. Mm-hmm. And the first thing to go was Medicaid and Medicare, because it was against the best interest of my patient, and it was very mercenary. You could make a mistake, and you were committing a crime. And it just became untenable. No matter what I did, if I underbilled somebody, I could go to jail. I was going to get fined. Well, who would do that? And ultimately, it's the whole medical system is supposed to work for us, the doctor and the patient. You cannot cede that power to a third party. They don't care. And I think that's where I've learned. I think my colleagues and I think patients are getting to the mindset of it should be about us, and anybody inserting themselves, telling us our value is a problem.
Yes. I think when it comes to doctors being able to try to create the best environment for patients, mm-hmm. we've seen certainly in our field, ambulatory surgery centers where on a smaller scale, the doctor can provide that patient, that surgical service at a much much less costly rate than what hospitals would charge for excellent care that is in a less threatening environment and something where the patient feels like they're a real person and not a number.
Agreed. I mean, as a surgeon too, the ophthalmology specialty is also on the forefront. And the good thing about ENT, and I correct me if I'm wrong, ophthalmology too, you don't need to go into a hospital setting to do most of your elective surgeries, right? So you can keep the cost down in an outpatient surgery center and really save your patient money. And is that also the case with ophthalmology?
Yes, it is. Yeah. I think some of the earliest ASCs were developed by ophthalmologists.
Interesting. And this is the cool part of your book, I'm sure. Part of that transparency is really, people don't understand this. And I've used to say this on interviews when I did talk shows, you know, or as a guest on a talk show. Mm-hmm. And I would tell patients it's cheaper to access the healthcare system if you don't use your insurance versus using just cash. And people would be just, they couldn't believe that was the case. And I think that's a great thing that people learn that.
Yeah, I think patients often don't know what their choices are. Mm-hmm. You know, it's part of the obscuration of the plans. And if you ever had a patient look confused when they were presenting you with an explanation of benefits, you understand that, you know, they feel lost. They feel lost at sea.
True. We do it sometimes.
I know.
As well.
Well, you know, when the Medicare manual is some 800 pages long, I mean, how are you going to be able to follow that and make sure you don't get tripped up on something, you know?
No, and it changes. That's the thing, too. You can get it down for 1 year, but it's completely different the next year.
When I found that these new changes that were occurring in the law about 5 years ago, I realized that if I wanted to still make eye contact with my patient and not mm-hmm. have to be turning my back to them to fill out check boxes on the computer, I hired a scribe. And that way I could look at the patient, I could get a history, the scribe would essentially record the pertinent elements of the history, the chief complaint, and what have you. And then I would dictate physical findings right there at the slit lamp as I'm examining the patient. Mm-hmm. And then I'd say, okay, and now I'm going to translate this into plain English for you, and here's my plan. And then I would look over her shoulder when I was about to leave after the patient had their questions answered and see that the record was complete, and I left. And I didn't do any stuff at home. And I just felt like this was an added expense on my part, but it was so that I could still continue to practice the way I wanted to. And having that eye contact and that sort of connection with the patient, I think, is really important.
It's energy. It's that connection that you, first of all, you care. And I don't think patients really, they deserve that. They don't deserve to have someone's back to them, spend 5 minutes, walk out the door and just throw a prescription at them, right, or call it in. But I also think that patients needed to ask for more. This would never have gotten to the point it was had patients had said, I'm worth more. I don't want to do this. And I'm not going to go to a physician who treats me like this.
Right.
So this is I would take responsibility for our health profession, but patients also need to take responsibility. They devalue themselves and they devalue the doctor. And fighting over a $5 copay and, being outraged that you had to pay anything at some points kind of set the stage. It ceded their control. And that time is the most important part. I know we both most likely trained the same way, where the history is the most important part of making the diagnosis.
Right.
It's not the examination. Examination is to confirm what you came up with in your differential during the history part of the exam. There's no time for that now.
Right. And I think you were right about the passivity that was expressed on both the patient and the physician's part, because we were sort of feeling like we had to knuckle under.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like if I could deliver the type of care I wanted to in a setting that I actually could control myself, then I was going to be serving the patient's interests, and I'll be able to sort of hire my own people and kind of run the show the way I wanted to. So yes, it was about getting some semblance of decision-making back in my own hands. So I didn't want to cede decision-making to a lot of other influences.
Isn't that, it's sad though, because even though we try to maintain that autonomy, the insurance companies, when they're involved, play a huge role. They get to decide what gets to be pre-certified. They get to decide what medications we want to give, how long we can give them.
Right.
And a lot of things, as a surgeon, you can cut to the chase and do what's necessary for the patient. Instead, for us, going through 6 weeks of antibiotics when the CT scan shows sinus disease, what's the point of that?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So you have the patient on this long haul,
right,
because somebody who decides, who doesn't know, these are not ENTs and ophthalmologists. I've talked to psychiatrists. I've talked to pediatricians to get a pre-certification.
Right.
And I think it's a conflict of interest, frankly. If you're working for the insurance company, how can you decide what standard of care is when my ENT specialty societies tell me what steps I need to take in order to take someone to surgery? We have no power in that. Patients don't understand that.
Right. And so one of the things that we object to in ophthalmology is this whole idea of step therapy. And maybe that's what you're alluding to, mm-hmm, where you have to start with one program or treatment or drug, where in fact, if you jumped to the more likely indicated procedure, drug, or what have you, read more expensive, you could probably save money in the system and grief for the patient. But step therapy has been this kind of imposition by people who they're not docs. They tell you, well, you have to do the mother may I can't take a step forward until I do these other things first. And to be second guessed by people who are not physicians is really insulting. Okay.
insulting. It could be illegal.
No kidding. So
they're getting paid for denial.
Yes, you know, exactly. Talk about a conflict of interest.
Exactly. And who stands to gain? That's always my question. It's always secondary is, or the corollary is follow the money.
Right.
If you're getting paid to deny services and you have a contract with the patient to help them take care of their health and you're not doing it, I mean, to me, it should be a class action situation or in some instances, perhaps even RICO, if you want to be honest. This is a huge system and a lot of money, but yeah. 1/6 of the economy.
Right. Well, I think having read your book about big medicine, I mean, there are plenty of big players besides just hospitals. I mean, certainly pharmaceutical industry and their pharmacy benefits managers have done very well as middlemen. And one of the things you talk about in your book is, you know, the cost of care is inflated because of all the middlemen.
Well, thank goodness. I think that's about to come to an end with the executive order about the PBMs and them being removed and that discount coming directly to the patient. I think we're in a position now where we can see down the road next month or in January, a real change in the healthcare system, because the people who've been wielding the power, who've been in the background, the PBMs, the hospitals, even the AMA for that matter, are now going to have everything open and it's going to be open to light and it's going to be examined. And I think people will be able to see for the first time that it's not the doctors costing everybody so much money. We're the front line. We get all the bad press, but it's not us. We're actually doing a service. A lot of the healthcare dollar is being paid to people who don't do anything.
Right, about 75% of the healthcare dollar, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think the question is, how can you restructure some of these arrangements? Because they've been kind of feeding at the trough for a lot of years, and how can you restructure our relationships? And I think you're absolutely right about, you know, transparency is the disinfectant that's needed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people start to distrust their healthcare, their plan, what have you, because it's been in a black box. Mm-hmm. And when you can actually start looking at the sources for the extra costs, then people can start to get a better feel. Plus, if they can actually see prices, you know, they'll be able to have a chance to shop prices. And I think there's something that I came across, which was, I think it was a comment by one of the reviewers of this new act that's going to come into play January 1st. And that is the cost for any providers, whether it's a hospital or docs or whoever, that's going to be information that's available to the public.
I think that's a great idea. And let's pick that up because I want to talk about your prescription, you know, what you think that we can do to rebuild trust. And on that note, let's take our second break. You're Living in the Solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with the author of Rebuilding Trust in Healthcare, A Doctor's Prescription for Post-Pandemic America. And Paul, before the break, you were really breaking down the problems in the healthcare system, but your book is about solutions and it's about positivity. So, I mean, we need to have this pendulum start to swing back. What are things that you think that doctors and patients can do to take our power back and to change this into something that works once again for us?
Well, I think part of it is that you have to rebuild trust between patients and doctors once again. And one of the things that physicians will want to be able to do for their patients is to be able to make decisions in what they feel is the patient's best interest, and can only do that if they're not being second-guessed. You know, they get beaten down by, you know, prior authorization and a lot of the nonsense that goes with trying to get what the patient needs, whether it's lab work or proper x-rays or studies or to see a specialist. And so it's going to come down to patients and docs being able to stand up and speak to these issues. And you mentioned something in your book too about you know, this is a time when there are special interest groups that are already spreading money all around Congress, and doctors need to be able to stand up for their patients mm-hmm. and be able to make the case that, you know, we are entrusted by the laws of the states to really be professional and be able to look out for the patients and to essentially have that altruistic approach as professionals. And one of the ways you rebuild trust is patients have to feel like the doctor is really in their corner and for whatever the fight may be. And so that could be legislative, it could be other things, but really I think the solutions that are going to have to come about may have to come, you know, in a very organic way. And you've found with your own practice that you start small and the ripple effect may start to really affect the rest of the healthcare landscape. So one of the solutions that I've come across is one, if you narrow the focus and you are dealing with employer-sponsored healthcare, which is under the ERISA laws, which are essentially the employee, let's see, I've got my notes here. It's the Employee Retirement Security Act of 1974. And so this law established employer-sponsored insurance, and it's strict in its protection of employees, but it's more flexible in how benefits are offered compared to the regulations imposed by the Affordable Care Act. And so I've been working with this company, Vextra Health, to essentially rework the relationship between the patient, the physician, and the employer, because mm-hmm. employer-sponsored healthcare is a major component for our country's healthcare. So those relationships are going to be win-win-win if we do this right. And I think that this particular approach is going to be perhaps very meaningful and might be used as a demonstration project in the future for, you know, larger programs or the entitlements and that sort of thing.
Well, I have a question about that. Is there a direct connection between the primary care or the direct specialist and the employer, or is there an insurance company as the administrator?
Okay, I think we're going to actually combine forces with the administration, because this will be end-to-end, soup to nuts, the patient as employee, right through the essentially concierge people, nurses and others who are going to help the employee navigate the healthcare system through the types of care that they're going to get and be administered in such a way that we can look at outcomes. And the important aspect is that the price that employers are going to pay is going to be reduced, because a lot of these middlemen are going to be working under different sets of circumstances. But I also think that when it comes to how the physicians are going to act within this system, they're going to be held to high standards established through both community and academic standards, and are held accountable. And for that, they won't have all the hassle. They won't have the, audits, the pre-authorization, the other stuff that really takes up so much time and energy. That's going to be eliminated, and the back office part of the administration side is going to be pretty seamless. So, I'm encouraged by this. In fact, part of the reason why I wrote the concluding chapter in the book is that I think there are some solutions, but these are very focused, and you have to start small and make it successful, do it right, and then we'll see where it goes.
Well, I just have something just came to my mind what about, is this an evidence-based approach, or are doctors allowed to practice the art of medicine just as much as the science of it?
I think they will have these unique relationships with their patients. It will be both science and art. But I think what they will also have to do is realize that there are probably some procedures or some frequency of procedures that may be outliers. And if you read Marty McCary's book, you know, they're using data to establish health policy. And the folks at Johns Hopkins have really been studying this for some time in order to look at what standards are like in communities with also standards that have been established through specialty organizations. So yeah, docs will be held to the highest standards, and they'll be able to practice the way that they feel they're trained to practice.
To me, I take a little different approach towards that. That's a data-driven, it's patient outcome-driven. How do you make outcomes happen? I mean, everybody's different. So
yeah, everybody is different. Like, and I think you know, what you're trying to do is say, okay, if your ENT specialty says that this person ought to have a surgery instead of 10 weeks of antibiotic, you're going to probably want to follow that directive rather than take some insurance, you know, stepwise approach to things and actually do something more definitive for the patient because you think it's in the patient's best interest. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think data is important, but also is personal judgment. And what we're hoping to do is get the thought leaders in these various areas, specialties, primary care, to be able to set these standards. So I think it's, you know, it's peer driven. It's not government driven. And that's the thing I think that's important. That's the distinction that I think is going to make this more acceptable and, you know, attractive to doctors.
You know, I'm going to play devil's advocate on this one because I personally don't think that it should come from academia only.
Oh, and no, that's where no, not only, not at all. No, in fact, if you read what McCary and his group talk about, they actually look at the community standards and clinical practice, not just ivory tower medicine.
Well, I don't know. I don't enter any information into these sort of things. I don't get questioned. So how do they know that this is actually representative of the broad stroke of what doctor, the care, the type of care that doctors deliver? And if it's going to be evidence-based, it's going to be pharmaceutical-driven, and what about the guys who and gals who want to do a natural approach? So there seems to be possibly... A natural, holistic approach to healthcare that doesn't involve writing a prescription every 20 seconds. Are they going to be the outliers, or they're going to have the second tier because they're just not as important? They're not going through the same protocols to get to the same results. See, I just think it should always be not top down in any sense. And aggregating data, to me, it just doesn't, it's not the art of medicine.
Well, I know. What I would say is that it's more the inductive approach. You know, we're going to find what works, what seems to be successful, and what standards have been established by the specialty. So yeah, I mean, it's not top down. It's basically saying what seems to work, what seems to be best practices.
Why do we need that exactly? Because a doctor and patient relationship is unique to me, and therefore my way of getting to the endpoint is different than a colleague down the road. But we get to the same endpoint.
If you can. And if you can get to the same endpoint, wonderful.
A happy patient and a patient who's discharged or healthy is the endpoint to me. So trying to make us all herd a certain way to get a data point it's not medicine to me. You're still having to jump through somebody's hoop. It may not be the government's, but it's going to be, you know, doctors in your community. That just doesn't sit well with me, I got to be honest.
Well, you know, you're such an iconoclast. What can I say?
I'm a freedom-loving person. I love what I do.
I know. No, you're fiercely independent, and I admire. I admire you.
I'm not alone, though.
I admire you for that. Come on, Elena.
On that note, let's take our last break.
All right.
You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Paul Pender. People need to go to his website, paulpendermd.com. You can buy his book, Rebuilding Trust in Healthcare, A Doctor's Prescription for a Post-Pandemic America, directly on the site. And I do love that. If you can cut out Amazon and go directly to you, that's what I'm all for, too.
I know. Absolutely. Don't take any detours. Elena,
no,
you go right to the heart of the matter.
Hey, I'm not messing around.
I know that.
Well, I mean, I appreciate academic medicine. It's not like I don't. I trained. I went to awesome institutions.
I know you did. I looked at your resume.
But it's different when you're out there taking care of your patient and you're learning things and you're going on the fly. There's something to be said for the dynamic side of healthcare, not just putting yourself in a box. I don't know. I've been innovative from the time I opened my practice, and it works for me.
And that's great.
I mean, great.
But you also attend medical meetings. You talk to colleagues. You find there are ways where you can build consensus and things that make sense to you. And you're gonna kind of take this whole, you know, salad of different ingredients and apply it in the ways that you think are going to best serve your patient. And that's the important element, really. It's you are integrating things in your own mind that you think are important for your patient.
As long as that is the end point and it doesn't get muddied in this pursuit of consensus, then I'm all right with that. And I had a corollary question about the how the ERISA plan in this system is set up. You know,
yeah, I'm not a lawyer, but I do think that it just provides greater flexibility for employers for the kinds of benefits that they can offer. So you know how the Affordable Care Act works. It was all you had to have all these benefits, whether you use them or not. You know, you had to pay for pediatric dental care, even if you were essentially in your early 60s and you didn't have children at home. Right. So, I mean, you know, the point about the flexibility side is I think that's what's going to allow employers to have a better grasp on how all this money is going out for benefits.
I don't think I was clear. My question is the relationship in this system between the doctor and the employer, or is there an insurance company acting as the middleman? Or is it just the doctor goes up, I can see all of your patients for X number of dollars and do these, and it's flat and you have
no, it's not.
Cafeteria.
No, I don't think that's how this is envisioned.
Okay. Well, who is the middleman? Who's administering it?
Okay. I think the company itself has the wherewithal to be able to administer the program for the benefit of the employer. Because in the past, there were third-party administrators for these major health plans, and they were stuck. They couldn't do anything innovative. They had to essentially use old hardware and old systems to try to deliver a product for the employer.
Right.
And now there's going to be some innovation that's going to be available that couldn't possibly take place under the old arrangements.
Okay, I get you now. So Vextra is the entity that the employer uses.
Contracts with. On a per member per month basis for being able to bring into the fold the doctor panel, the nurses who will help navigate with the patient through the whole business, someone that they can pick up the phone and say, I've got a question about such and such. How can I get this accomplished? And so, you know, part of the problem with healthcare now is that there's so much uncertainty. Mm-hmm. People don't know what entry point they should be in, right? So I think this will help because there'll be professionals there to guide them.
On the flip side, on the doctor side, are you looking more towards doctors who are independent, like the direct primary care physicians and specialists, or still working with hospital-based doctors?
I think that we're not excluding hospital-based doctors, but I think, unfortunately, they are already they're under the control of their masters, right? I mean, if you are a salaried employee of a hospital, you don't have the independence that other docs do. So, you know, part of my reason for getting involved with this really has to do with, can we create a viable alternative to hospitals just taking over all doctor practices? Can we allow independent physicians and private practice to still survive? Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm involved in this.
Well, it's admirable because to me, the best part of healthcare is the independent side who haven't ceded control to these corporate entities, and they have a direct, you know, relationship with their patient, and they can keep the price low. And I think, you know,
I'm with you on this. Okay.
No, I'm just saying, I think the Affordable Care Act was the best thing that happened to us initially, because it made doctors have to make a choice. Either you gave in completely or you stood your course. This to me is a secondary positive. And the fact that it's going to be listed what the costs are for an ENT in a hospital base with the, what do you call those fees, facility fees versus somebody independent. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to help the independent side and independent practice. And I think I would say that employers, knowing that they can work with your organization and be able to take care of their employees and not be, you know, priced out the way they've been.
Right.
This actually, you put pressure on the system.
Well, think about how the employer has had to deal with this. They would have a broker come to them. They would say, well, you know, I'm sorry, it's going up 10%. Your costs are for healthcare benefits are going up 10% this year. But I got it down to 8% because I've worked with this, you know, a major insurance company, and they're willing to do it for only 8% increase. Well, in fact, mm-hmm. you know, those are fabricated numbers. And you have to look, too, at the health insurance brokers who are getting retention bonuses for still being able to kind of take the employer by the hand and lead them back to the company that is making unbelievable amounts of money mm-hmm. because they're public companies and they have to answer to their shareholders. So it's, you know, it's one of those situations where the employer has really felt as inadequate in dealing with the structure as the docs. and guess what? It's the employer that's paying for the benefit. So I think working with employers in a more just way will allow them to feel like, you know, hey, we're all in this together rather than on opposite sides of the table.
Oh, you're describing the power of transparency. I mean, I assume getting doctors who are going to say what their costs are up front, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So that means there's no graft going on and there's no hidden fees.
No.
And I mean, that's a positive for everybody, I think. And again, this system is, to me, it's been opaque, and those that stood to gain have really gouged
right.
everybody.
Yeah.
And their goal was to put us out of business. No, there's no competition. You can make the price whatever you want.
Right. I think, you know, Too many docs have just rolled over.
Agreed.
And that's part of the problem. And there are so few of us left that believe in being able to support private practice that mm-hmm. that I was looking for a lifeline, frankly. You know, I was looking for a reason to think that, hey, there's an alternative to this downward spiral of mm-hmm. of just race to the bottom healthcare with the entitlements and the federal government telling us what we're supposed to do. So I'm hopeful, you know, as my book says, I'm hopeful that we can come up with something that's better.
Well, I think you have actually, because it allows, I mean, the employer healthcare and, you know, slice of the pie is actually quite large.
It is.
And if that can be something that is price transparent, that really puts the heat on the people who've been jacking the price up. And I think it educates employers and then by default their patients or their employees, which are our patients, that there's a better way. I can get a CT for $500. I don't have to go to the hospital and spend a couple thousand. You know, all these things, they shop for everything else. Now, I think we have to teach patients how to be consumers of healthcare.
Right, right.
And that benefits everybody.
Right. And in the past, they've had nothing to go by.
They,
you know, how can you shop if you don't know what the price tags are, you know? So
I agree.
Anyway, I we're probably getting near the end of our time here, but I just want to say this is a discussion that should continue, not just on your program, but I mean nationally. And you're the one that really raised the issue about, you know, docs having to speak up and do so publicly mm-hmm. and to do so as advocates for their patients. And that's something that I really believe in.
Well, we both love what we do. I mean, we spent all this time pursuing the skills in order to take care of our patients. And it's frustrating. And at one point, it was depressing to not be able to do that. But I love the fact that you've taken your power back and you're giving patients and doctors a method of taking their power back, not one size fits all. I think there's lots of ways to do it. And that's the cool part. You have a method, which I think is working. Mine is a little bit different, but we all want the same thing. And that's the key. And I want to thank you so much for coming on today because it was an eye-opening conversation. I think we both want the same things. We're just coming at it from slightly different ways, but I think your way is admirable.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about some of these issues with you. And these are things that are kind of bubbling in the minds of docs. Mm-hmm. You know, I really think that maybe what they're looking for is an alternative. Because from our perspective, and I think I can speak for you, is that we really believe that, our roles as physicians is it's a calling. It's not just an answering of a job description. So if we can actually encourage docs to find an alternative to what they may have feared was their only way out, then you know what? I think that we've done our job.
I couldn't have said it better. In the few seconds we have left, how can people reach you and get your book?
Okay. So they can reach me through my website, paulpendermd.com. And there's instructions there for being able to order the book. And, you know, I think, I would also say that I finished it during the COVID lockdown. So the material is up to date through June of this year. And hopefully it'll still be relevant when people decide to buy it.
I'm sure it will be. I mean, it's truths about the power of the doctor-patient relationship. That's timeless, frankly. I think we need to just get back to that.
Well, thank you so much for letting me be a guest on your program. I really appreciate it, Elena.
It was absolute pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.